This is HPR episode 2223 entitled, Fosdem 2017K, Level 1, Group B and C. It is hosted by Ken Fallon and is about 115 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, Ken interviews the projects in Group B and C of the VK Building Level 1.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi everybody, I'm at the ReactOS booth and I'm talking to
Colin Fink.
Hi Colin, can you tell me what ReactOS is?
So ReactOS is an open source effort to create an operating system that can run all applications and drivers written for Microsoft Windows. So we are basically trying to establish the Windows platform as an open source platform.
That is fully supported and maintained, bug fixes maintained, I guess.
There's an active development community around it. It's still a big effort. We're still having much work to do, but it's emerging very nicely, and more and more Windows stuff is working nowadays.
Okay, what sort of applications can you get running on it now?
For example, MS Office 2007 runs nicely already. We have recently got, for example, the Java platform or also .NET running on it. More and more applications written for these languages are supported. Right now, what we are showing here are also laptops which run with the common Windows drivers. So, for example, this is using a third-party Broadcom network driver.
Always the bane of everyone's life.
I'm sorry?
Always a problem for people, Broadcom drivers.
We have the advantage that we can use the official ones by Broadcom and don't need to resort what others are supporting in their free time.
Okay, and so how stable is it? Is it? Can you use it? Could I run an organization on it at this point?
It's not yet ready for everyday use and for every task, but for example, we have some users already who just need Windows for a single purpose. Like there's one application that requires Windows, and if that one runs in a VM, you can actually, ReactOS could be a solution to them already at this stage.
Okay, very good. And what have you planned coming up this year?
For this year, first of all, we have planned to be more present at exhibitions like FOSDEM or also upcoming ones like at Chemnitz or in Bonn. What else? There's currently a huge effort to support Office 2010, the more recent version, and then also 2013 and all that, so more support of really those what you would say killer applications for Windows. I think this will be a huge effort that's going to be done in 2017, as well as, for example, more stable USB support. Right now we are still distributing CDs, giveaway CDs here, but we're looking forward to do that with USB drives in the future.
And who is supporting the is there anyone supporting the project financially, or is it entirely community-based?
It is entirely community-based. We are totally running on donations, but we are having a German non-profit organization handling this, and due to some very successful fundraising campaigns, we are having some money now for which we can use to fund the development. For example, that Office 2010 effort is currently being done by some paid developers who are fixing those issues nobody else wants to look at. You sometimes have this problem, and then it's good when you have some money for paid development. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much for taking the time, and good luck with the rest of the show.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Hi, everybody. I'm at the Haiku booth, and I'm talking to...
François.
Hi, François. What is Haiku?
So Haiku is a free software operating system that is not a GNU Linux distribution. Yes. There are other operating systems around. You might have heard of ReactOS, and there's also a FreeBSD, NetBSD, and there's also Haiku. And Haiku is inspired by the B operating system, which was around until the end of 2001, which was a proprietary operating system, but we thought it had interesting features, and we didn't want to see it go, so we just rewrote it.
Completely from scratch. And what language are you using to write it?
So yes, almost completely from scratch. We reuse other blocks from free software projects like FreeType for the fonts and other stuff. But the Haiku code itself is mostly C++ and some more C in the kernel, but there are some C++ stuff in the kernel as well. So yeah.
And how well has the take-up been of Haiku? Do many people use it?
I didn't really check the figures, but I could talk about the committers at least. There's more than 100 people who are ever committed to the main repository. We now have a ports repository, so people contributing recipes for porting software. Last time I checked the figures, there were like more than 200 committers, different committers. And it's probably more now because we participate in the GCI, the Google Coding contest. So we have students contributing recipes every year, and it's really really interesting seeing them learn Haiku and contribute to it.
Is it then more an academic project, or do you envision millions of desktop PCs running Haiku in the future?
World domination?
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's more of a pet project. It's really fun to do. And, well, we try to do something different so to make people see that there's not only GNU Linux. And also, well, come up with new ideas that Linux distro can copy from us, maybe.
So what is, if you can describe the desktop to me that I'm looking at, what makes it different than a traditional desktop like KDE or GNOME?
Well, it might look a bit oldish in the style.
Retro is the word you're looking for.
Yeah, retro is the word. But, well, we like it that way. We don't really fancy bubblegum effects and everything. But, yeah, it's quite sleek, I think. The window tabs, they are really useful because you can drag them. You can hold shift and click the mouse and drag them. And you can group windows. So you have tabbed windows, and you can group them, and so it's really it's interesting. There are some nice features as well on the file system. For example, we support extended attributes, so it's basically metadata that you attach to files. But BFS actually can index them, so instead of having to run an update DB every night to see what changed in the file system. Well, you just let the file system handle it, and you just run a query, and it's instantaneous. So
that's interesting, actually.
And yeah, we use it for the mails, for example. So each mail has a file with attributes. So basically, the mail client is just search in the file browser with the mail status equals new. So you just see the new mails.
Oh, very good. So this is, I think Microsoft were talking about doing something like that a long time ago and dropped it.
Yeah, I think they were trying something, they kind of call it like WinFS or something. Yeah, well, BSD did 15 years ago, you know.
Very good. And is it easy enough to install, or are we talking specific hardware here?
On most PCs, it actually boots quite well. We still have some driver issues, of course, because it's not Linux, so we need to write drivers. We do have some help, for example, for our network drivers. We wrote a compatibility layer, so we can actually port FreeBSD drivers without much changing them. So we don't have to maintain a separate port. Because I remember people from RTEMS, it's an embedded operating system, they first tried to port the BSD drivers one by one, and then it was a mess to maintain, and then they switched to some glue code, separate glue code, and it was much easier, so we just did the same as they did. But for graphics driver, we support VESA modes on most of the graphics cards. We still lack some 3D stuff, drivers, for example, but yeah, well, it's in the works.
Okay, can you use it for a daily driver? Can you email? Can you surf the net? That type of thing?
Yes, well, we have a mail client, we have an IRC client, that's important.
Yeah. Here at least, yeah.
Yeah, sure. We do have a native browser now that uses WebKit. Well, if people are interested, we are still wanting for Firefox ports, because we did have a Firefox port back, it was like version 2 or something on BOS, but you know, it's like, let's ditch native backends, let's use Cairo. And then we ported Cairo, and then they said, oh no, Cairo is bad, let's use something else. And then we said, okay, we'll just wait.
You want to have somebody who knows Rust now?
Yeah, exactly. That could be an interesting idea for like GSOC, the Google Summer of Code contest, maybe, if anyone is interested in porting Rust to Haiku. We still miss LibreOffice ports. We have Olivier around here, who actually started an OpenOffice board back before the fork. I think some people expressed an interest in finishing the port for the Summer of Code, so maybe, who knows.
Okay, thank you very much for taking the time, and good luck with the project.
Thank you.
Hi everybody, I'm at the Gen 2 booth and I'm talking to
Matthew Doty.
And Matthew, can you tell me what Gen 2 is?
Gen 2 is a source-based Linux distribution. I tend to like to think of it as a meta distribution where you can just kind of build your own Linux distro as how you like it.
So this was an immensely popular project a few years ago, but it seems to have waned a little in the meantime. Would you agree with that statement?
I wouldn't say that the popularity has dropped. I would say that the buzz around it has dropped. Yeah.
Okay, that's fair enough. So how do I get into Gen 2? I have a brand new laptop. What do I need to do?
Well, we have a couple of live DVDs here that you can do. We also have, you can install really via any bootable media, like CentOS CD you could use, Debian, doesn't really matter, as long as you can chroot in it. And we have really, really good documentation for installing. The install process is mostly manual still. We have a stage 3 is what we call it.
So you've got the stage 1, stage 2, and stage 3. Yeah. So what are the differences?
Very quickly. Your time starts now.
Very quickly is optimizations and how much of the system it contains.
So say somebody relatively new to, or say somebody like with a little bit of experience in Debian, bit of experience with Arch, wants to move to Gen 2.
All right. little bit of experience. So if you've experienced Arch and Debian, then you've experienced some manual installs, which is a good thing. And it will be a little bit hard at first, just because there's a lot of flags that you can do to turn on and off things. Like, I like to use the example of LDAP. Not everything uses LDAP, so you can turn that off on a lot of packages if you don't need it, and just have smaller binaries.
Okay, but say then my boss comes to me and goes, I need you to turn on the one thing that does require LDAP in all your applications. Then what do I need to do?
Oh, then you need to recompile. But if you're deploying out to many, many servers or many desktops, it's not as much of a problem because we have binary package support. So you compile to a binary and redistribute that, and Portage just automatically portals that down when the use flags match something that's already compiled. And you're good.
And can I take advantage of that then if I'm installing a system myself?
You can. There's a few bin hosts out there. I don't know of any off the top of my head, but they exist, and you can just use those to install the base system and then optimize later on if you wish.
And general package maintenance, is this as difficult in Arch Linux? Does it require a lot of reading in order to do updates?
I don't think so. Like, honestly, I updated a couple packages just this morning here, and it was copying the renaming the file.
Simple as that.
Yeah, simple as that.
So basically, if you want control of your system, you can use Gentoo.
Yes.
Very good. Okay, anything else that's coming up that you've milestones that you've hit this year that you want to talk about? Any successes?
We're rolling distributions, so milestones are kind of a difficult topic. We don't do milestones very often, mostly when we just release DVDs like this.
You've got a really nice Gentoo ecosystem graph down here.
Yeah, CoreOS even is based off Gentoo. They use our build system and stuff in the back end, e-builds and whatnot.
I see System Rescue CD, Sevion, Google Chrome OS. I did not know that. And I know a lot of server deploys. A lot of people use Gentoo in the cloud.
Yeah, I work for a cloud company and maintain OpenStack within Gentoo. And it works just fine. Using Gentoo in the cloud typically requires using the bin packages I mentioned earlier, because you don't want to compile and just waste time and stuff. But it works great, the optimizations that you can get, because cloud providers tend to ship generic stuff, and sometimes you want to use SSE optimization that's not in the system of Debian or Arch or whatever.
Yeah, because you know what you're running it on, and you can strip out all the cruft that you don't need.
Exactly.
And put the stuff in that you do need.
Oh, yes.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for taking the time, and good luck with the rest of the show.
All right, thank you very much.
Hi, everybody. I'm at the CoreOS booth, and I'm talking to
Brian Redbeard.
Hi, Brian. Sorry?
Redbeard.
Where did you get that name?
It's a little bit of a nom de guerre, as it were. It actually started as a pejorative in middle school, where other kids would make fun of me because I could actually grow a full beard in middle school, and my parents wouldn't let me shave.
Very good. That's a story for another time, but we're here to talk about CoreOS. What is CoreOS?
CoreOS is a minimal operating system specifically designed to run containers at very, very large scale.
And it's based on?
It's actually based on Gentoo. We use Gentoo under the hood as an actual SDK for building the entire operating system.
Okay, awesome. And that's a lot of buzzwords you got in there. Can you explain to our regular old listeners what a container is and why I would want a special operating system for that container?
Absolutely. So a container is actually just a set of components that the kernel provides that are carved out so that you have separate namespaces for networks and users and mounts and things like that, so that you can actually bring multiple user lands on top of a single kernel and run them concurrently at the same time. So this means that you can actually then segment things out and have a Debian user land running an IMAP server with, you know, a Red Hat user land running a full HTTP stack, and be able to pick and choose the exact libraries from the distros that you want and compose them together in the way that you want to use them.
Okay, and where does CoreOS come into this?
So very, very early on, we realized that being able to automatically update systems and build higher order distributed systems was a really going to be critical to the security of the internet. So we wanted to come up with a way where it became easy to move a workload from one machine to another, and containers were very, very critical in doing that. So we kind of started out with LXC very early on, then we moved to Docker, then we kind of created our own container runtime to be able to manage things exactly the way that we saw kind of the most optimal. And being able to have that stateless machine under the hood that could schedule a workload and move it around made it much, much easier to automatically update things and fail across hosts when you had transient hardware failures.
So does CoreOS run on the native hardware providing the Docker containers, or does it run within the Docker containers themselves?
It actually runs underneath the hood and is the thing that actually spawns the containers for you. In a lot of cases, folks actually run it as a virtual machine, though internally we actually use a lot of physical hardware, so it ends up being the hypervisor for containers in that case.
Okay, so physical hardware, then you would have CoreOS, then you would have Docker.
That's absolutely correct.
And then on top of that, you have Red Hat or Debian or whatever else.
Certainly.
And then CoreOS provides the tools to migrate and expand and increase memory and stuff like that.
Exactly. And we also have built in a lot of, as I was saying earlier, like critical things that you need for distributed systems. So we have a distributed key value store called etcd that actually allows you to replicate configurations across machines. We also have a container scheduler that we collaborate with on Google, or collaborate with Google on, called Kubernetes, which ends up being an entire scheduling system for ensuring that, you know, you have n number of copies of a running application always at a given time, routing the traffic to it, etc.
Okay, very good. So where can I get more information about the project?
So going to coreos.com and also checking out our CoreOS user and CoreOS developer mailing lists.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Is there anything that you want to bring to our attention come up during the year? Or
certainly. So coming up in the end of May and early June in San Francisco, we have CoreOS Fest, which is our annual user fest, where we kind of bring in folks from the community to share both the things that they've done and the ways that they're using technology built by CoreOS.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for taking the time, and have a good show.
Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. I'm here at the Debian stand, and I'm talking again to
Sebastian.
How are you?
I'm fine.
So, for the people who don't know, what is Debian?
Debian is the universal operating system, one of the oldest Linux distributions, completely staffed by volunteers, no company supporting it.
And yet, it's one of the largest distributions out there in the commercial field. How did that happen?
Probably because there is no company behind it, no mandatory support contracts like Red Hat, etc., and probably because it is a true free software operating system.
Okay, and what's your involvement with the project?
I'm a Debian developer. I maintain the geospatial and OpenStreetMap related packages.
That's right. Listen, what have you planned for this year? What happened last year in the Debian community? What's coming up this year?
What's coming up this year is, of course, the stretch release.
Yes.
Of course, we never know when the actual release is going to be, because it's going to be there when it's ready, but my expectation somewhere the third quarter this year. The freeze is coming up tomorrow. That's the hard freeze, no new packages, etc. So if things work out with the OpenSSL 1.1.0 transition, we might be able to do it sooner, but
So what's that transition? Is that there's always seems to be one thing that causes a problem? Is that?
Yeah, fortunately it was not a game this time. I remember Frozen Bubble causing a delay in a previous release. But the thing with OpenSSL now is the OpenSSL maintainers would like to have OpenSSL 1.1.0 in Debian stretch, because of the support for the ChaCha cipher and other improvements in OpenSSL.
Yeah.
On the other hand, OpenSSL 1.0 is the long-term supported release, which makes more sense for a Debian stable release. And the biggest problem is that the API broke, so a lot of software needs to be patched to work with OpenSSL 1.1.0, and with many of the packages in Debian, they simply don't have that support yet. So we now have both versions in Debian, but not all of the packages, far too many, still haven't been rebuilt with either one. So that's one of the biggest pain points to sort out now.
Okay, last year when we were talking, the big issue was switching to system, our
System D.
How has that turned out?
I think the big fuss is over now. The Debian guys have started up their alternative. I think they've made the first release now, so everybody who doesn't like System D has a nice place to go. Yeah. And everybody else who didn't make a big deal out of it is happily using it. And
life goes on.
Yeah, exactly. It's been almost 3 years now since the release of Jesse, which made System D the default. And I think we're most people are pretty much happy with it. It works.
And Debian, what other events are going to be happening around here in Fostem this time?
Well, as I said, we have the nice blog post on bits.debian.org with a list of Debian-related speakers here, at least 45, as I see right now. So that's good. And of course, we have our general attendance at the booth to answer questions.
Sell t-shirts.
Sell t-shirts, exactly.
Sell swag. Well, thanks very much for taking the time, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
I will. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm at the PostgreSQL stand, and I'm talking to...
This is Robert Evans.
Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
Doing good. Yeah, how are you?
Can you tell me what PostgreSQL is?
PostgreSQL is a an open source relational database management system coming out of a project at Berkeley University, became open source, and it's been picked up by an international community worldwide, and being sponsored by many different companies. And it's essentially owned by nobody. In the same way that Linux is not owned by anybody, so it's a true community product.
Okay, very good. And how many developers are involved, and what language is it written in?
Ah, okay. It's written in C. How many developers? Hundreds. I mean, many. Yeah. It's just so we got a core team, we got a hacker team, we got a lot of people around it as well. So we. Being involved or being employed by different companies from different backgrounds, yeah, that project. Yeah.
Are there any full-time developers in a PostgreSQL building, or is it people working for HP who are contributors?
It's working people working for like NTT in Japan, but also consultancy companies like Enterprise DB, Second Quadrant, etc. But also like VMware. Provided code for the project as well. So there are many different companies that are involved in the development of the project. So yeah.
Okay, very good. And it's becoming quite popular now to run it in the cloud. It seems to be. So how would you suggest that people would best deploy PostgreSQL in the cloud?
In the cloud. Well, most cloud providers actually have Postgres in the cloud. So Amazon has a Postgres service. There are also other specifically SaaS providers that provide Postgres as a database as a service, essentially. Like CitusDB, like Heroku, and there are many others.
What has made PostgreSQL the de facto choice there for that?
The de facto choice?
It seems to be extremely popular. Why is it so cloud friendly? When it didn't obviously start
right.
Cloud like?
Yeah. Well, cloud friendly. I mean, like Amazon actually changed the code a bit, so to adapt it to their environment and to their services. I mean, the whole source is open. It's a sort of a BSD license. It's actually PostgreSQL license, which is even freer than the BSD license. So it's essentially just you can do with it whatever you want.
So a friendly license, open source code, a lot of people using it. Amazon supports it. If Amazon supports it, everybody else has to support
exactly.
it.
Exactly, yeah.
So a win-win for everyone.
It's definitely a win-win, yeah.
And where did the logo come from?
The logo? Actually, we got two logos. So the elephant logo, I think it comes from, or at least the name, sorry.
It's fine, we'll, where did you go? Our recording device has just fallen down, my backup recording.
But we're going to keep going, and I will not edit. No, we never edit.
Right, exactly. Okay. Not sure where the elephant comes from. Might come from our Russian developers, but definitely the name of the elephant, Slonik, which is Russian, comes from Russia. We got a bunch of developers in Russia. Coming from the Moscow University, now they're actually got their own companies, and it's really booming in Russia now as well. But in Japan, we have the turtle, because the elephant has a different meaning there, because there was a group using the elephant, and there were kind of a terrorist group. So that's that's not good. It was a sarin attack in Tokyo with them, so it's not good. So they got the turtle, but the elephant is the official sort of international logo.
So is there anything cool coming up this year that we need to be aware of? Or
This year we're going to have version 10, so we're going to go from 9.6 to 10. There's a lot of work being done on logical replication right now. Many new features, and the community is also growing. We got some really nice conferences coming up, like in New York. In Europe, we're going to be in Warsaw, in Poland, in November. It's really booming, development wise, but also community wise. So.
And you just. Are just a member of the community, or do you work for a consultancy company or something?
I'm actually self-employed. I'm a developer, and so I use Postgres. But they're core members here that actually code on the product, on the project. So we're a wide variety of people. I mean, we're users, we're consultants, we're core developers here. And spouses as well, so everybody's
family of her.
Exactly, yeah.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for taking the time, and have a great show.
Sure, thank you.
Hi, I'm at the Nextcloud booth, and I'm talking to...
I'm Frank Kalicek.
Hi, Frank, and can you tell me what Nextcloud is? It seems to be a new project here at Fostam.
Absolutely. Well, it's half new, I would say. So I'm the founder of OwnCloud, which is a well-known open source project, and basically the core developer group and the community and me, we forked it like 9 months ago into Nextcloud as the next generation. So it's, in a way, it's very new, yes. It's like 9 months old. But in another way, it's actually the community and the software and everything is already established for like 7 years now.
So you invoked the open source thing, you took the code and you forked it.
Yes, exactly. So, like I said, OwnCloud was founded by me, and quickly we built a community around it, and later a company. And there were some problems with the company, which led us to the decision to fork it. So basically, I forked my own project, which is a bit funny. But not only me, but really a lot of community people. As you can see here, the booth, there are a ton of community people and volunteers here. And this is like the power of open source. So I'm really, really happy that it works like that.
And I see that OwnCloud are still here. Are you maintaining contact with the developers level at least? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I said hi like a few minutes ago, and we talked with some of the developers a few days ago. So yesterday we maintained contact on a technical level. On the business, on the company level, well, we have different directions, different focus now, but sure, I mean, we are still friends, of course.
Of course, it's a two-way street. They can also take your code and continue to use that. Agreements of the license, obviously.
In theory, yes. They decided that I don't want to use our code, but it's their decision. But everything we do is HEPL, so everything we do is 100% open source. it's not open core like others. So obviously this means that everybody can take our code and do whatever they want with it, yes.
Was there a was it an important decision to pick AGPL?
I think so, yes. Yeah. So I picked the AGPL license 7 years ago when I started with OwnCloud, and I think I got really good feedback with it. So we all the developers, the contributors seems to be happy with it. And we are also working together with the Free Software Foundation and in the US, the people who actually invented the AGPL, and seems to be the best license for this kind of software.
Yeah, served you well. And have you, what sort of language is it written in?
So, Nextcloud is written like in a ton of different languages, actually. So the server component.
It might be no harm to tell people what Nextcloud is at this point if nobody knows.
Oh yeah, of course. Good point.
Just remember, there might be some new listeners.
Absolutely. So Nextcloud is the original idea was to have something like Dropbox and Google Drive, but completely open source, and you can host it yourself. So you can basically go to our website, you can download like a zip file, you can put it on a Linux box somewhere, and then you have your own little Dropbox and Google Drive for your friends and family and maybe company or university. But over time it became bigger and bigger. So now we have a very good calendar. So you can synchronize your calendar with your phone and your desktop and share the calendar with your family and your colleagues. An address book, there's a news reader, there's a mail reader, a chat app, there are all kinds of features. And now with Nextcloud, we also added like video and voice conferencing. So as you can see here on the booth, there's a demo where you can basically have video and voice communication with others. And it's all, like everything, completely self-hosted, completely encrypted, completely secure, completely private.
Very nice. And what sort of a box would I need to run this on? Can I run on the Raspberry Pi, for instance?
Yes. So you can run it on a Raspberry Pi, not the Raspberry Pi 1. I mean, it kind of works, but it's really, really slow. But Raspberry Pi 2, a newer, is really, really fine. This is good for like a small group, like 3, 4, 5 people. But if you have more users, then we recommend like a real Linux server, and we can also cluster to lots of servers. So the biggest installation has several million users.
And where is that? Can you say?
Sorry?
Can you say where that might be?
So the current one that's in production is in India.
Yeah.
It's a few million users. But we are actually working together with a big customer, because Nextcloud is also a company who is deploying it for over 20 million users. So it's really nice, because it's the same software that works from very, very small, like a Raspberry Pi, to very big.
Okay, cool. And have you anything planned this year? Is it more just tidying up, getting the Nextcloud brand out there, consolidating, or are you going to have events, or what's the plan for the year?
Oh, wow. So that's a lot. So, last year when we started Nextcloud, there was a lot of consolidation, like also rewriting proprietary components into open source and a lot of brand building and everything. And now this year we really can move like full steam forward. We're going to a ton of events. So there is like just OSCON this year, then there is Scale like in Los Angeles in 2 weeks, and the Mobile World Congress, and a ton of open source events. And of course, we also have our own conference, Nextcloud conference, which is hosted at the University of Berlin in August. On our website, there's more information. And these are just the conferences. And then we just have like the usual hackathons in between, where people come together. We have very active meetups. So we have regular meetups in, I don't know, 5 or 6 cities, like regularly, every month. And people coming together to work on Nextcloud. And these are just the events. And then, of course, we have like big plans for the software too. But this is something that, yeah, you will see over the year. There's a lot coming.
It seems like you're going to have a very busy time. Listen, I won't take any more of your time. Thank you very much for the interview, and good luck with the show and the project.
Thanks a lot.
Hi everybody, this is Ken. We're here at the Bazel booth, and I'm talking to...
Hi, my name is David Stanky, product manager for Bazel.
And what is Bazel?
Bazel is a build and test system. It's based on the system built at Google over the past 10 years called Blaze, designed for massive builds with incredibly fast reproducibility. And Bazel is our open source version of it. We open sourced it in 2015 and are looking to build a community.
So would it be similar to Jenkins or something like that? Or
so Bazel works at a lower level. Bazel is similar to a Maven or a Make. It's the thing that does your compilation and your test of your code base. You can plug it into a Jenkins or other CI systems.
And what is it written in? What language?
It's written in Java.
I was expecting Go there, to be honest.
Not yet. Certainly, we love Go at Google. And Bazel can be used as a build and test tool for Go. But Bazel, part of it, the story of Bazel is that it's multi-platform out of the multi-language and multi-platform out of the box. So it's first-class support for C++, Java, Python, Go, and it's extensible to support any other language that you can think of.
Okay, so what are your plans with it? How old, Google released it, and what now?
Well, Bazel is fully open sourced at this point. We have a great community of contributors, both to the core platform and to the extensibility side, where there are people writing rules for Scala, for Rust, for Clojure, and we welcome anyone who's a language expert to please help us build that community. Beyond that, it's a matter of continuing to grow. We recently released Windows support and are hardening the core, looking to build towards a big open source release of a 1.0 with a governance board and all of the great stuff that comes with having an open source community.
And so exactly, say I've got a little app, where does that fit? Where does Bazel fit into my app? At what point?
I've
got an application written and a low world application in, I don't know, C. Where does this fit in?
So you're going to use Bazel as part of your build and test cycle. So as an engineer, you write some code, you hit compile, it runs, right? The beauty of
Bazel... Ship it to the
not, well, no, because you've got to make a change. So the beauty of Bazel is we maintain what we call a dependency graph, meaning that we analyze your code and know what every piece depends on every other piece. If you make a change to one file, we're only going to rebuild and retest the pieces that depend on that one file. Everything else retains its build and test status from before. So that makes incremental tests lightning fast. So as an engineer, you can build and test at every file change. And in fact, we have there's a way you can use Bazel where it monitors your file system and automatically rebuilds and retests every time you change a file.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Very interesting.
Good. And how difficult is it to install? Is it available on most distros, or do I go to the website and pull it down?
Go to the website and pull it down. You can compile from source or pull the binaries. We have, of course, an active project to get it into the distros, but we're not there yet.
Okay. Any weird dependencies or anything like that?
Just a Java runtime is all.
Okay, cool. So what's coming up this year that you want to make us aware of?
So I think this year is a lot about productionizing for Bazel. It comes from the Blaze, which is the tool built at Google. It's been around for 10 plus years, meaning we have a very strong core. It's a much more mature product than you would think based on how long it's been in the wild. We are working with the communities to really make language support for all the different languages work really well, increasing our strength in sandboxing so that your builds are really reproducible. They're not dependent on anything that's on the local file system. And hardening Windows support is a big part of what we're doing right now.
And what was the motivation if after 10 years that you were using this as a tool, why even bother open sourcing it?
Well, one thing that happened is that a lot of Google open source projects, say something like TensorFlow, they have Googlers and then they have external contributors. And the Googlers are really used to using this tool and love it. It's harder for them to make contributions in an environment that they're not familiar with. So by opening that up, we make it lives easier for Googlers. As the external community starts to experience it, they get excited about it, and then that continues to pull it out. It also helps with, you know, spread the word about how great Google engineering is, helps with recruiting efforts, and helps for new Googlers coming in if they understand the tools that we're already using inside.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you very much for taking the time, and good luck with the project.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Hi everybody, I'm at FOSDEM, I'm at the OpenQA and the Open Build Service booth, and I'm talking to OpenSUSE.
Yes, it's Richard Ram, the OpenSUSE chairman from the OpenSUSE project.
So tell me, what are these services? Why are you What are they, for a start?
They're the secret source of the OpenSUSE project, really, and not just the OpenSUSE project. So the OBS, the Open Build Service, is our build system, building all of our distributions, including the enterprise SUSE distributions as well. And it's the only build system that is fully dependency aware. So it knows, it's trying to build a cohesive product. It doesn't just see packet a distribution as a pile of packages, but as an interconnected weave of things. So when something changes somewhere else on the stack, it knows when and where it has to rebuild everything. So it's always pumping out, in theory, ISOs and disk images that are, you know, a proper working distribution.
So, for example, if I have just one text file that's local to my app, my app gets compiled. If it's the C library, then everything gets recompiled.
Yeah, exactly. So it takes care of that. But of course, building's great, but in reality, does it actually work?
Yes.
And in the past, this is something that every project and distribution has dealt with, and normally dealt with like with passive testing. Like, I'll just throw it out to the community, put it in some testing branch somewhere, and hopefully it'll work, and if nobody moans about it in 2 weeks, then we ship it. That's not good enough in this day and age, especially with something like OBS, where we're changing an awful lot of stuff all of the time. So OpenQA actively tests our software. It actively tests our distributions from the same perspective that a user is actually going to do. So it's actually firing up VMs. It's actually controlling real hardware, and then actually loading up the operating system, clicking on the same menu buttons the user's going to click on, typing the same thing the user's going to type, reading the, looking at the same screen, actually doing open computer vision, OpenCV image matching of, does this have the UI elements I've been told to look for? And then driving through an installation or an upgrade, and then actually using the operating system and its applications the same way a user will. And if that all passes, then it's good enough to ship.
Could I use that then for checking websites and the like?
Yeah, totally, if you feel like it. In fact, we test OpenQA, which has a web UI, in OpenQA. So it's a little bit confusing when it's testing itself, but yeah.
That's more the human element. I'm sure it has no problem with it. And where do I... Open Build Service is something that's hosted by SUSE as a thing for the community?
So yeah, Open Build Service is software which you can download anywhere. The OpenSUSE Build Service is SUSE's sponsored instance for the community. So it's an installation which SUSE have, which anybody can use. But if you wanted to download OBS and run it up on your own servers, fine, have at it, have fun.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and in fact, lots of companies have Dell, Linux Foundation, VLC.
So just to clarify people, because every year we do the same interview, so we presume that people will know, but the Open Build Service, if I have a small little app, I can just upload it there and it will create not only the OpenSUSE RPMs, but...
You can make the SUSE RPMs, the SLE RPMs, you can build Arch packages, Debian, Ubuntu. I've lost track of the amount of distributions it's now. It's like up to like 32, 42 different distributions.
Say there was a Debian package produced by Open Build Service.
Yep.
Can I sneak that into the Debian repository, or have they got more requirements?
But if you build it properly, then it'll be submitted and accepted fine. I mean, there's no reason why not. Yeah.
So with zero knowledge whatsoever, you can maintain your package.
Yeah.
That's actually excellent for another thing that I intend to do.
Cool.
This Open Build Service sounds really cool.
OpenQA.
Open Build Service, that's really cool. Moving to the OpenQA, which I was then pointing at.
Yeah.
How do I get that? What do I need?
There's no public instance for people to dive in and use in the same way as OBS. You can see openqa.opensuse.org, which is our public instance. You can see openqa.fedorahosted.org, which is the Fedora project instance, because we're not the only people using it.
We can download the software, run it internally.
And you can go to open.qa, that's where the software is, that's where the source code is. It's also where all the sources for our tests are, so you can see actually how we've written all of those tests for OpenSUSE and even the SLE stuff. Like, we're not shy, SUSE aren't shy with hiding the enterprise stuff away.
Is it difficult to write a new test?
Not really. It's got its own kind of bespoke domain-specific language, which, if especially if you're a sysadmin with kind of a Perl history, it's really familiar. But if you don't like Perl, we've abstracted most of that away now, so, you know, it's semantics, but really, in reality, there's effectively a macro language of type a string, check a screen, assert the screen, so, you know, check and fail if it's fatal, that kind of thing. So there's a little bit of an API you've got to learn. Once you've learned those commands, you can write very nasty tests just by arbitrarily running those commands, you know, macro style. If you then want to get fancy and start programmatically doing stuff like look at the screen, check for this element, if this element there, go off and do crazy stuff, we've got all that power in there too. So you can do really dynamic tests of actually reacting to stuff you might not be expecting, and then have OpenQA still work. So we can teach OpenQA to like work around its own bugs and that kind of thing.
Okay, fantastic stuff. I will definitely be looking at that because I have a requirement in work for automated testing. Thank you very much for taking the time and enjoy the... Anything cool coming up with OpenSUSE related to these projects yourself?
The main cool thing at the moment is sort of Tumbleweed, where, you know, our rolling distribution, which is kind of the embodiment of those two technologies, being, you know, done full blast. Of course, we've got Leap, which is our enterprise-based community distribution. And we've got an interesting challenge coming up at the moment because 42.3, so the third iteration of the SLE 12 based Leap, is on the way this year, and in parallel we're developing the new code base for SLE 13/Leap 43. So it's going to be a really busy year for us doing kind of two code bases in parallel, and we'll be leveraging all these tools, because if this stuff doesn't work the way I just said it did, we're screwed. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. And thank you very much from the community for providing the open build service and this software.
Yeah.
All right, enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Hi, I'm at the FSFE booth, and I'm talking to...
Florian Snow.
Hi, and what's your relationship with the project?
I'm a volunteer, so I help out here at the booth, and I organize a local group in Franconia, in the upper part of Bavaria, northern part.
So this is the Free Software Foundation Europe.
Exactly. So we're like the European spin-off of the Free Software Foundation that was started by Richard Stallman in North America.
Can you tell people who don't know what that is?
Well, it's an organization that supports the political work to support free software and like the societal change to enable users to have freedom in their computing.
So by freedom, you mean everything's going to be just, you know, you don't have to pay for it, I guess.
No, we actually mean free as in freedom, not free as in price.
Well, surely you should call it freedom software then. Sorry, I just did a show about that, so I'm taking a joke too far. So it's important work that you're doing, and is there many people in the organization?
Yeah, there are many fellows, as we still call them. We're changing that right now to supporters, who support us as volunteers and who donate money. And then there's a few employees who like coordinate work in a central location.
What are we planning to do this year? What cool stuff's coming up?
There's going to be a talk about the radio lockdown directive that we've been involved in. There's a European directive that says you cannot change the firmware of any radio, that device that has a radio inside of it. So that would involve free routers and would maybe prevent us from having
ham radio stuff also. Yeah.
There's going to be a new campaign. Since the stickers are out, I can name it. It's called Public Money, Public Code. So there's going to be some action on that. There's going to be I Love Free Software Day again in February.
Okay.
So,
good stuff. And where can I get more information about the project?
The best way is to go to our website, fsfe.org, and just check it out there and get involved with us.
No harm to donate some funds as well if you can.
Of course, like we always are happy about donations.
Excellent stuff. Thank you very much for taking the time and enjoy the rest of the show.
You're welcome.
Hi, I'm at the Vikings Libre Hosting Provider booth, and I'm talking to...
I'm Thomas.
Hi, Thomas. What is Viking Libre Hosting?
So Vikings is a new project which does basically Libre-friendly and sustainable hosting. That's the main focus, is Libre-friendly and sustainable.
So I see behind you 100% Libre-friendly, 100% Libre software and boot firmware, and 100% green, zero CO2 emissions. How do you do that?
So we basically have the... most modern platforms are usually encumbered by proprietary hardware, firmware, and software. Like the platform we use is the Vikings D16, which is based on an ASUS mainboard.
So this is I'm looking now here at a pizza type server.
Exactly. And this has been reverse engineered by the Cobalt people, and which allows to run this mainboard completely with Libre software. So the BIOS is completely Libre, and if you also run a Libre operating system on it, you have a full stack Libre system, which allows us to provide for Libre hosting. So basically we will provide email, storage servers, VPSs, also dedicated servers based on this machine, and sustainable we do we basically go into data centers that already exist, which get the energy which is certificated by, for example, Greenpeace, so an independent organization which says, okay, they use energy from this or that factory, power plant, yes. And so it can be made sure that it's completely green and there's no CO2 emissions at all.
That is an astounding feat, but where's the catch?
Well, there is none.
It's going to be more expensive, though, than your average everyday run-of-the-mill hosting.
Actually not, because the platform we use is quite recent. It's been still sold, and has been sold since 2012. It's still very powerful. We have two CPUs with 32 cores, up to 256 gigabytes of RAM. So it is a platform you can use for the next at least 3 to 5 years. And after that time, we will probably gear towards the power platform, which will provide for even more power. That is really, well, how can I say that? It's at that time it will be more efficient, like monetary-wise, to use this platform. This will be at some point. You will always use something more powerful to provide better prices.
Do you go into one data center, or do you have multiple servers and multiple data centers? Yeah.
Originally, we have planned to build our own data center, so we can provide full physical security. We have done a crowdfunding last year, which ended last month, and it wasn't very successful. So now we are doing basically plan B. So we are going into existing data centers and enable them, so to say, with our Libre services and our Libre hosting platform. So by doing that, we save a lot of money, of course, with a catch that we can't really provide for complete physical security, because it's not our data center. We will have some hardware that will provide for that, namely Flexware, which will be developed this year and will be sold this year for this mainboard. So with this Flexware, you can provide any system based on the D16 server anywhere, even in the US. So if somebody changes the hardware, like, for example, the NSA takes the server out of the rack and they tamper with it, you will find out about it. And you will be notified, and you can say, oh no, somebody has tampered with it. I will, for example, if they flash another firmware, you can say, oh no, I will just reflash my firmware. Or you will say, no, I can't use the system anymore. Yeah.
No more trust in that server. Okay, that's an interesting approach. Do you think that has there been a lot of interest in?
Yeah, actually, we have a lot of despite the failing of the crowdfunding, we have a lot of interest, especially from the US, for people who are really worried about the current situation. Oh, I wonder why. And I think that we will succeed with this.
It seems logical that if you have a, someone like Greenpeace, they should be running their servers on, energy neutral servers. They should be running a website on, it seems like a logical thing to do if you're into there's a whole industry sector there that should be running their servers on something like this. So it's a good opportunity. Where did the name come from, and where are you based?
Well, we are based in Germany currently, and the data center, we can actually go in any data center we want to. Right now, we are in a data center in Frankfurt and in a data center in Nuremberg. So customers, potential customers can set up a strategy to have redundancy, for example. And the name Vikings, it's just a cool name.
It has nothing to do with your beards or anything?
It has nothing to do with my beard. And basically, the Vikings were people, well, what we know, they fought for their rights. They were not only people who went to England and killed everyone for the gold and silver. They were people who, normal people like you and me, who were worried about their future, and they fought for their own future. And we are doing the same. We're not killing anyone. That's the difference. But we're also very worried, and that's why we are offering this project to the people.
Okay, so how do I sign up? What are the prices? What sorts of solutions are you offering? And where do I go to?
Vikings is a very new project, so we are still in the startup phase, and there will be a pre-ordering going until the 1st of May, when we will go live with our platform.
And it's Vikings.net?
It's Vikings.net.
Vikings.net. Fantastic. Thank you very much for taking the time, and good luck here. I hope you'll have lots of people signing up.
Thank you too, Ken.
Hi, I'm at the General Tor Network stand, and I'm talking to
Tuvari from Front von der Ön.
And what is that?
Well, Front von der Ön is Luxembourgish and stands for Friends of the Onion. And we are a TorServers.net partner organization, which means that we run Tor nodes all over the globe.
Okay, now I'm going to, as you're the first one here, I'm going to need to ask you the question, what is Tor and what does it do?
Tor is a software that you can use to anonymously serve the internet. That's basically what Tor does, and it helps people all around the world to communicate with other people and to securely communicate.
And how does it do that?
Well, it's doing it with the so-called onion routing, which means there are multiple layers of servers that it will use to get to the internet site you want to visit.
So who started this project?
Who said? You mean the Tor project or our organization?
The Tor project to start off with.
The Tor project. Well, there were some fancy guys that thought, okay, we need anonymity in the internet, and which got help from the U.S. government with governmental funds, and which are now spreading the word of Tor, and we are trying to get organizations like ours to run the infrastructure.
Okay, and basically I can browse anonymously using the Tor browser?
Well, pretty much now, yes.
And the Tor browser is based on what underlying system?
Well, it's using the Firefox with some modifications that it like something like to block JavaScript by default. And which use the Tor as a proxy server.
So I've downloaded that application, and it seems trivially very, very easy to use. Is it still safe if it's so easy to use?
Well, we are trying to make it as safe as possible and as easy as possible, which always means that we have to adjust things, because normally if you make things easy, means that you are offering or... which reduces the security. And that's always a game we have to play and to get in on the same equilibrium. And it's pretty hard, but we are trying to make it as easy and as secure as possible.
And what's your organization? What does your organization do?
Well, our organization, which is based in Luxembourg, is currently trying to get more exit nodes and bridge servers on the Tor network.
So what's an exit node, and then what's a bridge server?
Well, an exit node is basically the last server Tor uses to get out to the internet. So if you are using Tor, the probability of going through one of our exit nodes is right now at 5%. So the website you are using or visiting will see the IP address of our exit nodes.
So if I if I'm browsing Google, for instance, and I come out at google.lu, is it? Then I'm coming out through you guys.
Yes, yes.
Thank you very much, Dad.
There you go.
And why are you here exactly? And who pays for these exit nodes? Surely there must be an awful lot of traffic coming out then.
Well, yeah, we are. We have generated like 20 petabytes of traffic for the last 3 years. And all the servers are running with donations from members or donations from, like here, the FOSDAM, or back in Luxembourg, we have the HEGLU and other conferences. So we depend on donations.
Okay, and what motivated you to get involved in this?
So the motivation was like that we had the first crypto party in Luxembourg, and we thought about, why not invite people all over the globe to come and speak to us. And we invited Moritz, which is the founder of TorServers.net, which already runs exit nodes all over the globe, just like we do. And he just asked us, well, guys, why don't you create an organization like ours, but in your country? And we were like, okay, well, we are from the Chaos Computer Club Luxembourg, why not? So we created it in 2013. And yeah, we began to run exit nodes. And now we have currently like 7 exit nodes in Slovakia, Romania, and Luxembourg, and a hell of a lot of bridge servers all around the globe.
What's a bridge server?
Well, a bridge server is mainly a server you use when you can't directly connect to the Tor network. Like in China, which is censoring connections to the normal Tor network, you have to use a bridge server to get around this censorship.
And is that something that does that need to be as high bandwidth as the exit nodes?
No, not as the exit nodes, because bridge servers are only used to make the first connection to the Tor network, and not every county censors the direct connection to the Tor network. That means that not everyone has to use bridge servers, only those countries like in Syria, Iran, or like China that are mainly using it.
So who can help out if they wanted to, say I have a 100 megabits internet connection, can I help out, or is it better for organizations?
Well, I recommend everyone to run it under an organization. Why? Because we had to go to a lawyer, which wrote us down the Luxembourgish law about hosting Tor nodes and doing all the stuff with the traffic. And it's a hell of a lot better to be in an organization, because when it comes heart to heart and the police is knocking on your door, you want to have someone behind your back. And in this case, it's our organization and the law.
So, if what do I need infrastructure-wise in order to be doing an exit node or a bridge node?
Well, if you look at our infrastructure, we are only hosting gigabit exit nodes. So that means we need at least like 16 gigabytes of RAM. We need an i7 CPU to handling all the traffic, and of course, unmetered gigabit connection to the outside world.
And who would be inclined to give that sort of service?
Well, not many ISPs, because there are also bad guys that use the Tor servers for doing spamming or DDoSing or hacking, and we are mainly
kinder porn, of course.
Yes, of course. And we are mainly convincing ISPs around the globe to allow Tor, because it's also used for good case. And we are talking to them, we show them, okay, those are the implications when you host it, what can you do, talk to us, that's the law in our country, that's the law in your country. And we have to convince them recently, much a lot than it was at the beginning.
Okay, but that might change, unfortunately, in the coming...
Yes.
Okay, anything coming up that I need to be aware of over the coming time?
Well, we are all day here at the FOSDAM, so you can go to our booth, just talk to us about Tor, about exit nodes, I don't know, about security, anonymity, just come by, drop us a word. We also have some gimmicks to sell, and, recently we are trying to, in our country, to go to the libraries. And say, okay, that's a Tor project. Why don't you host a bridge server at your facilities? And those are some flyers. Just educate the people about Tor. And we are trying to get in contact with libraries.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much for taking the time.
No problem.
Yeah, sure. Very good.
Hi, I'm at the Zen booth, and I'm talking to
Julien.
Hi, and can you tell me what Zen is, and specifically what Zen Orchestra is?
Zen is a virtualization solution, and Zen Orchestra is a web interface for it.
Okay, so what's a virtualization solution?
It allows you to create virtual machines and to abstract physical resources.
Okay, is this more like VMware or more like Docker?
More like VMware.
So I could run Windows on a Linux machine.
Exactly.
And so that's been going for a while. Is there support for Zen in most distributions and in the kernel?
I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
Is there support for Zen in the kernel?
I don't know about that.
And what is Zen Orchestra then?
So Zen Orchestra started as a web management UI, but now it's more like a cloud light solution based on top of Zen. So you have a self service. You can create users, delegate some resources. You can schedule some backup jobs, and you can administrate your servers from everywhere because it's a web based solution.
So you can add servers. Can you increase the size of disks, for example?
Exactly. Yes, you can do all that. You can start migrate your machines.
And how do I go install that?
You just have to get on GitHub. Our GitHub, the whole code is here, and you have a link to the documentations, and then you can find how to install it from the sources. And if you are an enterprise and you don't want to handle that by yourself, we also sell a solution when the Zen Orchestra is already bundled in the virtual machine.
Okay, very good. And is there any major updates coming this year? Have you added new features in the last year?
Yes, we've worked a lot on backups, Delta backups, and file level restore. But this year we'll probably be more about hyperconvergence. And hyperconvergence, you know, it's when each host is not only a compute node, but it's also a storage node, because we are using GlusterFS on top of it, so the whole storage is seen as a single storage unit with a replication. So this is the main feature for this year.
Okay, very good. And are there any conferences or events coming up that you'll be at?
We don't know yet. Probably Xen Hackathon and maybe LinuxCon in US.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
Hi everybody, I'm at the OpenStack booth at FOSDEM, and I'm talking to
Aurelian.
Hi, and what is OpenStack?
OpenStack is a project managed. I'm sorry, I'm very bad at this.
Take your time, there's no rush.
Okay, OpenStack is aimed to bring a kind of AWS from Amazon inside your walls, so you can keep your workload inside your walls.
So it's a private cloud.
Yeah, it's the main, I would say, private cloud system you can have in your company.
Okay, so this is large corporation has a data center and they wanted to be able to provide AWS-like services, then we could deploy OpenStack.
Yes, OpenStack is the main, the principal project you could use to do that.
And is this supported by one company or is it multiple companies?
So OpenStack is backed by the OpenStack Foundation, which is composed of very large companies. They have support from Red Hat, IBM, I think there's SUSE too. The main distribution vendors, provides OpenStack distribution and OpenStack support and consulting. There's also small companies, like the one I'm working for, providing that kind of support. But the main big Linux companies can help with OpenStack.
Okay, and so how do I deploy it? What do I need? I've got my hardware. What else do I need? Where do I go?
Okay, so if you want to try it at home or just to make a small lab, you can use DevStack, which is a suite of tools made for you to deploy an OpenStack on your laptop. You can deploy a working OpenStack on your laptop. You're not going to have very big performances, but it can give you a hint on how to use the web UI, the APIs, and so on. When you want to go further and deploy that on multiple servers and go more production-like, you can use project like OpenStack Ansible. There's also RDO from Red Hat, which I don't know very well. You can also use vendors distribution like Mariantis OpenStack, or I guess Suzy has their own too.
And the OpenStack itself, is that like the virtualization, or is it the containers, or is it all of the above? What?
OpenStack is a suite of tools. Mainly, basically, it exposes you APIs to talk to make a virtualized environment. Behind OpenStack, if you want to know what runs your VM, it can be KMU KVM. It can be Xen. It depends on how you want to implement your OpenStack cluster.
Okay, so it's quite flexible in that.
Yeah, it's very flexible. Also, for the storage of your VMs, there's a component called Cinder, which can be backed by a lot of backend, which can be Ceph for the software-defined storage. It can also be your big appliance, if you have a three-power appliance or big SAN you want to still use, you can do that as well.
And do you support software-defined networking as well?
I'm not very knowledgeable in that, but yeah, OpenStack, the network in OpenStack is managed by Neutron, which is software-defined network because it uses OpenVSwitch. It can use OpenVSwitch, Linux namespaces to do switching and routing between instances inside your OpenStack cloud.
Okay, very good. So, what's your involvement with the project?
I'm not involved a lot in the project itself, but I worked with OpenStack daily for a customer, and I wanted to be here to tell people about OpenStack, explain them what it is. Like, people are asking, oh, I got GPU boxes I want to share with people. Can I share them with OpenStack? Can I expose them with OpenStack? So, yeah, it's interesting to share that knowledge.
Cool, very good. So, do you know what the plans are for OpenStack during the year? Are there any events coming up or any developer conferences that we need to know about?
The main OpenStack Summit is going to take place in Boston in May. There's also going to be a smaller, more very, very technical meeting in Milano, I think, very, very soon. And in November, the next OpenStack Summit will be in Australia.
Oh, very good. Okay, enjoy the rest of the show, and thank you very much for filling people in on what OpenStack is.
Thank you, have a good day.
I'm at the Overt booth and I'm talking to
Yaniv.
Hi, and what is your relationship with the Overt project?
I'm an Overt community member. I'm part of the development team. I also develop Overt as part of my work at Red Hat.
Okay, very good. And what is Overt?
So Overt is a complete data center virtualization management system. You manage your host, you manage your virtual machine and all the infrastructure around it. Essentially, it gives you an infrastructure as a service complete solution.
Okay, and how is that? Is that using OpenStack at all? Or
no, it's actually partially overlapping with OpenStack, but OpenStack is more towards cloud, and we are more towards data center virtualization.
Okay.
So yeah, we both use KVM, we both use Leveret, but the use cases are a bit different.
Okay, and what's the difference?
So for example, in OpenStack, virtual machines can come and go. They're less more of a pets, kind of, where you actually nurture them, you take care of them, they live longer and so on. You care less about those things. In data center virtualization, yes, you do. In OpenStack, you wouldn't necessarily over-provision because really cost is an issue that rolls out to the customer. In data center virtualization, it's your cost, so you will over-provision. You will optimize the hell out of your data center.
Okay, so this is for your own data centers as opposed to running something in the cloud?
Mostly, yes.
Okay, and do you have a lot of interest from people running this?
Yes, of course. So we meet a lot of our users year after year here in the conference. We hear a lot of people that actually heard about it but haven't tried it. We hear a lot about people who are using VMware and are looking for an alternative. And Overt is a great alternative in two ways. First of all, it provides very, very similar functionality, but also it enables a migration path, so you can actually import your virtual machines from VMware to Overt, try it out, see how it works for you, while keeping your VM in the VMware environment. So these are the two main characters of users that we see here.
So it would be more a VMware replacement, a VMware Studio replacement, than for something like Amazon Web Services, I'm guessing.
Yes, it's going to be a VMware replacement. It's going to be a replacement for people who actually run already VMs using KVM Livery, but doing it themselves. Now, it's okay if you do it for one server, for two servers, but it really doesn't scale up.
Okay. How does what sort of things can I get now as a customer of that? Do I get snapshots, backups?
Everything you can think of. We have hundreds of features. All the top features that are critical for virtual machine management are there. If, of course, running them in sophisticated web with kind of scheduling, live migration, live snapshots, live hot add of disk, hot add of CPU, of memory, of network card, anything that you can think of, really, including a very extensive ecosystem. So everything you can do from the user interface, you can do from the REST API, you can do from a Python SDK, a Java SDK, a Ruby SDK, and Ansible, which was just released, actually.
That's funny you should mention that. I may be interested in that on a professional level later on. How would you recommend running, say, a cluster of databases to keep high availability of databases? Is that something that you can solve with this?
Yes, of course. So we have support for high availability of a virtual machine. We actually, in the very latest release, which we just released 2 days ago, we introduced a new highly available architecture for virtual machines. You can easily do that. We have great integration with Gluster, actually. You can actually run hyper-converged scenario, so your compute and storage host are essentially the same.
Okay, very, very good. And Gluster is the distributed file system, which I still need to do an interview on.
Right, that's good.
It
that's
might even come before this, you never know. Right. Magic of podcasting. This is a Red Hat company, and is this... am I required to go to Red Hat to get contracts for this, or can I just download the source code and compile it myself?
No. Overt is a community project. It's on overt.org. Yeah, we have a very vibrant users community that are contributing, especially to the ecosystem. We have a contribution, for example, for a Vagrant provider. We have someone who wrote a CLI around it. We have someone who wrote a monitoring agent solution around it. We have quite big community involvement in this. If you want to buy a product, yes, Red Hat Virtualization is the downstream product for Overt. And, of course, we're heavily involved in Overt development.
So it's going to be in Overt before it's going to be in the Red Hat version?
Yes,
okay,
definitely.
Cool stuff. So anything new that's come up this year and that you've been working on? What have you been working on this year?
Well, of course, since we just released a new release 2 days ago, especially for FOSDEM, our milestone was exactly to meet the FOSDEM timeframe. We're very excited about this release. It's a 4.1, so it's the first stable release that we've done after the big 4.0. It still contains lots of features. I'm very excited of many of them. We've contributed the Overt Ansible modules to Ansible 2.2 and 2.3, actually. We have a discard support and storage, which is a boom for storage efficiency and utilization. We have moved to a kubectl 2 version 3, which enables high performance. We've improved the scalability of the database, and so on and so on. So lots of needs and pieces everywhere that can help you improve the user experience, and the dashboard that we introduced in 4.0 now loads much faster in 4.1, and we're still continuing to fix most bugs, improve stabilization, improve scalability, and add more features.
So what's coming up next year then? I've never satisfied me. What's the plans?
Well, for example, we're using the Patternfly open source design patterns. We are now upgrading to a newer version, so the UI will look even better. We have a new user portal that's coming up. We have integration with the Open Virtual Network, which is a software-defined network solution on top of OVS. So that's coming up. It's already in tech preview. It will move to production. And there's plenty more to see.
Excellent stuff. Anything else that you want to tell us before we go?
No, as always, very happy to hear. Very happy to hear the different workloads and different kinds of setups that we see from our user and the community. I'm always looking for positive feedback on the product. Always looking for what can we improve, where can we improve, and I'm very happy with the community of giving us this feedback.
Oh, they'll give feedback here, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, and good luck with the rest of the show.
Thank you.
I'm at the Foreman booth and I'm talking to
Greg Sutcliffe.
Can you tell me what Foreman is?
Sure. So Foreman's a lifecycle management system. It aims to help you deal with the whole of the operations necessary to manage your servers. That could be physical servers, that could be virtual servers. So that's not just configuration management, but also provisioning, integrating with services like DNS, DHCP, maybe IPMI, BMC stuff, whatever you need to get into in order to bring your servers up, get an OS on the disk, up and running, into your infrastructure, monitor them over time, and eventually deprovision them again at the end.
So why would I even need this when we've got the cloud?
Well, we can talk to the cloud. That's absolutely fine. We can talk to physical systems. We can talk to physical-like systems, such as Overt here next to us, or you know VMware or Libvirt. But we can also talk to EC2, DigitalOcean, Rackspace, GCE. If all you want to do is spin up an image, that's fine. But that's not part of your infrastructure yet. You can spin up 1,000 servers, and they're useless to you until they're doing some work. And that means you've got to get your application on there. You want to get it maybe hooked up to Puppet or Ansible. So there's some one-time steps that need to happen. And you want to also monitor that, right? You want to see those Puppet reports coming back and have a nice front end to that. So you can see what's happening in your infrastructure and find out whether there's a problem you need to investigate, nice graphs for your ops team or your management, all that kind of stuff.
So how does it work? I order some servers from Dell and I put them in my rack, then what?
Okay, so first of all, you'll need Foreman somewhere, right? Foreman is a Ruby on Rails application, so it needs to live on the network somewhere. And we have little pieces of Ruby code called the Foreman proxy. We put those on the services that need managing. So DNS, DHCP, these things, we put little proxies out there. That gives us a consistent API to talk to, allows us to scale out nicely. So you still only need one single Foreman, one source of truth on your network. So we have a rack of hardware. Now you have two approaches. Physical servers are an interesting use case because we never know the MAC addresses in advance, right? If I talk to Libvirt, I can get a MAC address back. So you could either write those MAC addresses down, put them in Foreman, or we have a plugin called Discovery, which gives you a kind of a metal as a service approach where we can boot them into a RAM disk and get the MAC addresses ourselves. Either way, there's some registration process, right? So you either do that yourself or you do it via a plugin. And now we manage the rest of the process. So in Foreman, you say, I want to provision this machine. It's going to have CentOS on it. And I want it to use this kickstart template and this disk layout and go. And as soon as you hit go, Foreman's going to hop out. And important to say, every part of Foreman is optional. So maybe you've enabled DNS and DHCP. So we go out, we say, okay, I know my MAC address. I can go to the DHCP server and get an IP back. Now I can write a reservation. That host is always going to get that IP. I can go to the TFTP server. I can write some Pixie code so that it boots into the correct installer. I can go to the DNS server and write a DNS record for my new hostname. And now it boots up into the unattended, goes through the unattended install, finishes that, tells Foreman it's done. We take away that Pixie code, replace it with local boot, and it comes back up into the network. And then you hand it off to Puppet or Ansible or whatever.
And the same sort of configuration for AWS.
Right, exactly. One of the nice things about Foreman is that UI doesn't change. You're still filling out most of the fields, but as soon as you say, I'm not doing physical now, I'm doing AWS, a lot of those fields in the network-specific tab will disappear, and instead you're going to say, okay, this IMI in this region, and everything else is the same, right? So the UI remains consistent. That's good for your junior ops people, good for your processes, all that kind of thing.
And then what comes on top of Foreman?
On top of Foreman, that's an interesting question. I'm struggling to see where you're going with this.
Right, if you've got integration with Ansible, then why would I need Ansible if I've got Foreman?
Because Foreman won't take actions. That's the point. Foreman sits there as a central point of truth and a way to drive things like configuration management systems, but it itself has no configuration management built in. So I can say, okay, I could manage my Ansible roles by hand, or I could import them into the Foreman UI and allow people to assign them to hosts and run them from there. But you're still running Ansible at the end of the day. It's just a different way of interacting with it. And so it's a question of what you need out of your infrastructure. If you're happy with doing everything on the command line, then you don't need Foreman to handle that part of it. And you can turn it off. I mean, everything in Foreman's optional. But if you do want to be able to do that from a nice UI and maybe build up things like host groups so you can group similar servers together with the same things, then maybe this is something you want to look at.
Okay, excellent. So what is the history of the project? What's the license, for example?
License is mostly GPL. Obviously, there's been contributions, and because it's a Rails project, you end up with plugins from different places and so on. But it's mainly GPL, V3. And the project's about 7 years old. It was started by my manager, Ohad Levy. And he has taken that over the last few years and grown it. We've grown it into a large team at Red Hat, mostly. I mean, it's fully open to contributions from the community, of course, as you would expect from a Red Hat project. But it's fair to say most of the development is paid for by Red Hat. And we're probably, I don't know how many people these days. It's important to say Foreman plus one of the larger plugins forms the upstream of Red Hat Satellite 6. So if you're familiar with Satellite 6, you're already familiar with Foreman, even if you maybe don't know it. So that's where it came from. It grew out of a need that OHAD had. That's a really bad phrase. And he took it from there. He joined Red Hat. They saw the value and grew it from there.
Excellent. So what milestones do we have last year?
Successes. That's a really good question because I've fantastic. So probably the most valuable thing we did last year was that almost exactly a year ago, we met up with the Puppet guys. We've been trying to get Puppet 4 support into Foreman for quite a long time. And we met with the Puppet guys, we hashed out a roadmap, and within about 3 months, by our birthday in July, we'd actually got a release out with full Puppet 4 support in it, which made the community very happy. We've been waiting 18 months for that. Also, one of our community contributors, a guy called Timo Goebel, he contributed a full IPv6 stack to it as well, so we now have proper IPv6 support throughout the project. So, I say full. Obviously, there's some edge cases, things like TFTP is kind of an IPv4 thing and so on, but you know, you can assign IPv6 addresses, get them from an IPv6 system, and pretty much everything you want to do with IPv6 is supported. So.
And this year, what are we looking at going forward? Are there going to be any meetups?
There's meetups in the next few days, actually, because we've got Config Camp next week. We'll probably do something around our birthday again. Nothing concrete yet, but we had a really good run of about 7 or 8 events within the space of a month around our birthday last year. I'd love to do that again. In terms of milestones, 1.15 will be out in a couple of months. That's got a new notifications framework in it, which is going to be lovely. I'm really interested to see what plugin maintainers do with this and what sort of notifications they want to give to users. Beyond that, it's hard to say. We don't really do roadmaps, so it's whatever lands in there.
Anything else we missed, or have we covered it all?
I think we've got most of it, to be quite honest. A shout out to Catello, our sister plugin that forms part of Satellite 6, and to all of the community who are absolutely fantastic. We wouldn't be where we are without them.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm at the Cluster booth, and I'm talking to...
I'm Mohammed Ashik.
I'm Chiffin Tony. Yes, I can.
And Kaushal.
And you need to write your name on the thing later on. And tell me, what is Cluster? What is Cluster? Is it Cluster FS? Why am I wanting to say Cluster FS?
Because Cluster FS is the, flagship project of the Cluster community. Yep, so Cluster started out as a software-defined high-performance computing or a supercomputing project effort, because the Cluster founders were supercomputing developers somewhere in the US. They started out doing a software stack for a supercomputer, but they found out that the storage part of the stack was a much bigger challenge, and they wanted to solve that. And that's where GlusterFS started out, and that's how it became GlusterFS. And right now GlusterFS is the flagship project, and it's... Yeah.
How does that differentiate then from Cluster?
So right now, Cluster and GlusterFS are interchangeable. But it started out as a part of Cluster. Yeah.
So what does it do?
You guys want to answer?
So basically, it's a file system, distributed file system. So applications can store their data in it. So there are servers and clients, and the clients can talk to different servers at a time in a single point. So that's our...
So I go to my etc fs tab and I mount / cluster, and that's it.
Yeah.
And
you
where
need
is
to
my
create the GlusterFS volume before, actually. So yeah, what I think Jiffin wanted to say was GlusterFS is a distributed file system where you install GlusterFS on different servers you want. You create a single volume out of them. So all of these servers together are available to your clients as a single storage device.
So I just need to mount it one place.
Yeah. So you can mount -T GlusterFS on your clients. You can put them in your FS tab if you want to. And your clients get the storage available from the servers. All of them in a single mount point. Instead of like doing separate mounts for each server, you get a single mount point, and GlusterFS handles distributing files across all these servers.
Right, I'm getting very nervous now because my family photos are stored on my cluster server. What if one of them goes down?
So we have replica options. In case of a node going down, you will not lose or you will not see any delay on data not being there. So if one node goes down, other two replicas will show the data on your mount points. So it's
like RAID only across servers.
It's not RAID, it's just replicas. So whole volume is created one more time and kept it there just for a backup. In case if you lose something, it will get the copy from there, or else in case if this node goes down, it will show to the mount point from there.
Okay, so how many server? So each of these servers will be running some sort of redundant array anyway, as a operating system. So on the underlying file system, is that also cluster or is that ext2?
The underlying file system is any POSIX compliant file system which has support for extended attributes.
Yes.
Better support. So some file systems generally don't do extended attributes really good. So XFS. Yeah, that's what we test on. That's what we, as Red Hat, the company, we do a lot of our development on. So that's what we're.
So I got now lots of servers. I've got two in each data center, three data centers. I make one cluster of everything. Do I?
In different data centers, I think one data center can be one cluster.
Yeah.
Other data center can be other cluster. If you want to have a similar volume both the places, you can use geo-replication. That's what we support. So you can have a separate volume here, and you will have one more volume there. And you have to start geo-replication session with this as a master and this as slave. Either way, so both will have the same content of data. If you mount that volume there, it will have the same data. And if you mount the volume here, it will have the same data.
But if I update on the slave, will my changes go back from the slave to the master?
Yeah. No, like you can do the changes of a master, it goes to the slave.
Yeah. But say I was in the remote location and it was faster for me to write to the remote location. I'm in the US and I want to write to my slave, which is in the US.
I guess it's not possible.
We don't support that right now. We are working on ways to probably do active-active or master-master replication. That's slightly hard to do.
Yeah, I've heard that, all right.
Yeah, you probably heard this the same the last time. We have been trying to do this for a long time. We haven't found the proper solution. So
generally, you would use the geo-redundancy for just geo-redundancy. Okay, cool. So what have you been working on the whole year?
I have been working on integrating Gluster with Kubernetes. So we have a plugin inside Kubernetes now. You can easily run your Gluster inside Kubernetes and also provide storage for other Kubernetes pods. Yeah,
I don't need to ask everybody, but in general, what's the project been doing?
Okay, so
any major releases or new milestones?
So we are planning to do a release in next month. Like Gluster 3.10. This month. Within 2 weeks, actually. So it has new features like with multiplexing and debugging features like taking the state dumps on GFAP clients and performance improvement, like kind of that. And yeah. And we have long-term projects which you can that goes later.
Yeah, so our upcoming releases will coming release we are mainly targeting improving our container kind of workloads. We weren't particularly suitable for the container scale where you would with the ASHIX project where we can automatically create volumes, GlustFS volumes on demand. With the way GlustFS worked, it wouldn't scale so much. So we have done brick multiplexing as Jiffin told. This enables us to run multiple bricks in a single process.
What's a brick?
A brick is basically a directory that GlustFS exports, right? So to export this directory, GlustFS runs a daemon we call GlustFSD or the brick daemon. So each directory would have its own daemon that was exporting it. But when you scale to the cloud or the containers, that isn't manageable a lot. We would waste a lot of resources, so we are working on making that better by running multiple or serving multiple bricks from a single process. That's one of the major things we are going to do. Apart from that, we are working on improving our performance, particularly for small files and those things where we got notification support that was implemented recently. That will in the future help us do better caching, and that would improve performance better. So that is in the upcoming release. We are also doing better
We're also doing a lot of work on our APIs, the GlusterFS API, GF API, to make it more suitable and give more features to it. And apart from that, in the longer term, we got projects happening to do server-side replication. So right now, GlusterFS works by doing everything on the client. So servers are generally dumb. Servers don't know what they're doing. GlusterFS client decides where the data should go, where it should be replicated and everything. But we are trying to do a server-side replication to reduce some of the load on the clients, because clients generally won't be as powerful as servers, right? So servers can do a lot more of the heavy lifting, so we want to do that. There is a new project to do distribution better. So we have a distribute translator which distributes files across, but that doesn't scale particularly well, so we are trying to improve that. And in addition to that, we're also working on a new management daemon, so called Cluster D2, which should help with our scale issues, and which should also help, newer developers coming into the project, because Cluster D is a really complex bit of software, and generally, if any new feature were to be developed in Cluster, for that to be available to end users, you'd have to do something in Cluster D. And for a developer who was working on that particular feature to come in and figure out what to doing Cluster D was a hard task, so we are simplifying that, cleaning that up, and there'll be a new daemon around that, and that's happening, so that should be in the next couple of releases. So yeah, these are our longer term goals right now.
Anything else, guys?
It's what Kaushal told is mostly internal to Cluster. So in integration parts, we also now support Cluster blocks, as in we have a way to export the Cluster volume bits into as a block. Now it is an integration part, not completely inside Cluster. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you very much, guys, and enjoy the rest of the show. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Hi everybody, I'm at the OwnCloud booth and I'm talking to
Holger Dyroff from OwnCloud. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
So can you tell me what OwnCloud is and why you're here?
OwnCloud is an open source file sync and share solution. So basically Dropbox for your own server and your own data center and your own Raspberry Pi if you happen to have one. And we're here to show people how OwnCloud looks like, and we're even printing some OwnClouds with an open source 3D printer today when you come by our booth.
Who made the printer?
Sorry?
Where did you get the printer?
This is from the Fab Lab Nuremberg.
Okay.
And it's all open source on GitHub and OpenSingy. Yeah, you can go out and print your own OwnCloud, which is kind of cool.
Kind of awesome. So there was a bit of a parting of ways during the year. So OwnCloud is still going ahead as a project?
Oh, absolutely. OwnCloud is strong going ahead as a project. We have rehired quite some people to get ahead and programming again. We're planning a 10.0 version for the spring. There are some exciting stuff upcoming, like integrity checking with checksumming, custom groups, so you should definitely have a look at the early beta versions there. And some people decided to go a different forked way, like it often happens in open source.
Yep.
But that's normal in open source, I guess. And there are probably different focuses. We'll see.
And what sort of license is OwnCloud released under?
So OwnCloud has a core version, which is OwnCloud Server, which is released under HEPL, so everybody can take that and enhance, like the fork did, right?
Yes.
And then we have an Enterprise Edition, which has very small additional features which are useful for very large corporations, maybe 500 users upwards, and that's under a so-called commercial license, which means those people still can have a full look at the source code, they can still modify it, but they cannot give it to other people.
Okay. Yeah. And it's been a busy year, I guess. But going forward, what's the plans?
The plan for OwnCloud is really to continue to provide a great product focused on the integration of the server side, the desktop client, Android and iOS devices and other devices as they come up, and really provide a great user experience between all of those.
Yeah?
And having functions not just in the web front end, but also have them accessible from the desktop side, with sharing API and all of those great items.
So as a, if I was a corporation rolling out these boxes or providing it as a service, I could go to you guys for contracts and support, no doubt.
Oh, absolutely. Right. So we sell subscriptions, which includes support and then also the right to do some modifications on your own and keep them if you like. So which some people like to do, others don't.
Yep.
So it's a freedom of choice from our perspective.
Absolutely. Okay, well, anything else that is coming up that you want to tell our listeners about?
There will be a new version of the desktop client, I think, in 1 or 2 weeks, version 2.3. Couple of exciting things like right-click share with email, which is something people were missing till now. Pretty easy feature, actually, but people will like it. And as always, it's going to be a new, greater and better version, which provides even better sync performance.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for taking the time and enjoy the rest of the show.
Very welcome. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm at the CA Cert booth and I'm talking to
Eva Stöve.
Hi, can you tell people what CA Cert is?
It's a free and open certification agency. So we provide certificates like Let's Encrypt, but we are older and a little bit different.
Okay, how are you so different?
Okay, our focus is on the identity part, the signing and everything like this, while Let's Encrypt mostly focus on the encryption. Both provide the encryption, but we provide also certificates that identify who is owning the server or the email or whatever you use.
Can you, so this whole process relies on the agents, yourselves, I guess, verifying the identity of the people who are going to be issuing the certs?
Ashura, we call them. We call them Ashura, yes.
So if I wanted to become an insurer, what do I need to do?
You have to get assured yourself to the maximum of points, 100 points, and afterwards you have to do a little test. You can do this test as often as you want until you have finished it. The reason is we want just that you know everything. We don't want to test you. We want just ensure that you know the things. And then you can start to assure others.
Okay, so what's the process? Let's pretend I was a newbie coming up to the stand here.
Okay, first you sign up on the website, or you can do it later, but the idea is that you sign up on the website first. Then you can already get certificates, but it's an anonymous certificate and we cannot say, well, it's you. If you want to be you, then you enter your, you ask an assurer if you can be assured. Then you fill up your form with your name, the date of birth, and your email address, and the signature and the date, and you sign that you accept our policies and everything. And then you provide your ID card or passport or driver's license or something like this, so some kind of official document, one or two. And then the assurer checks this documents, and we are told we do more or deeper checks than most police or something like this. And
yes,
we know
the
what
checks are very thorough. I've done this.
And then we do little, ask questions or something like this to just ensure that the person is seems to be honest. And then we sign it and compare. We compare the picture and the signature and everything to the person also, so we really identify the person, like on a PGP key signing, but a little bit deeper process. And then we enter this on the website with some points, and then we're done.
And the whole point system, the more points you have, the more trust you have, because you've been... So I could go with my cert to you, and I could go to somebody else, and I could go to somebody else, and that proves to more people. More people are saying, yes, I am who I say I am, so therefore my trust level in the network goes up.
Exactly. So we start with one assurer who can give you probably up to 35 points. You start as assurer with 10 points maximum, and the more you assure, the more points you can provide. And you need 50 points as assuree, so the one who gets the assurances, to get certificates with the names. And 100 points to get an assurer yourself, and also for code signing certificates. But you can get as many certificates you want all the time.
Okay, very good. So the more focus is on building the trust model. So have you been able to get any of the master certs into any of the browsers or as yet?
No, not yet. We had one attempt of an audit, which is some years ago, and this was in theory quite positive, but there was one element where it was failed, and we did not manage to start another audit since then. And actually, currently we would be more interested in the audit as such, and not, it would be a nice bonus to get into browsers, but we actually believe that the system with browsers and browsers accepting certificates is broken, because, why are you going to a certificate agency to get, to trust the certificate agency? And, you don't see it in the browsers, so now you trust the browsers about the certificate agency and you don't select them yourself, and that's just broken.
Yeah, so you've gone to all this work to trust everybody, and then you go, now it doesn't matter.
Exactly, so that's, we want to be able to pass an audit eventually, but, it would be a nice bonus to get into browsers for us, but for us it's more the idea to get the policies correct, the processes correct, the trust level adjusted, and that's more in our interest than, it would be nice to be in the browsers, but...
Well, there's nothing to say that a piece of technology won't come around when everybody has got a level of trust to go, okay, this is how we're going to implement it, and now we put the root certs, and if the trust level of the root certs is over 14 million, then... We can say more or less, and of those people, you can build a technology for trusting the root cert.
Yeah, exactly.
The work on trusting people still needs to be done.
Yeah, exactly. So for us, the more important thing is that our members can trust us, and that's what we care most about. Sure, we know that we would get a lot more members and everything if we would be in the browsers, and that would be great and everything. But we don't want to give up the trust of the current users, the current members, and that's our focus.
Okay, so what we're saying is, for people who want free and easy certs, go to Let's Encrypt. For people who want trusted certification from the ground up, come over to CA Cert.
So if you're only interested in the encryption and easy handling and everything, go to Let's Encrypt, and it's great that they are there, because they cover ground that was not covered before. We are happy to have them. We have some ideas maybe to join into it. We discussed something today that was quite interesting. Not with Let's Encrypt themselves, but with somebody who has some ideas. And yes, we would... if somebody is likes this, it's enough. And if it's what they need, it's great. There was nothing like this, and we could not provide it. So we are really, really happy that they are there. But we provide something differently. It's a different service, I believe.
Yeah,
and
I think so too, as well. Yeah.
So...
Well, thank you very much. Was there anything coming up that we should know about, or can you encourage people to start joining?
Yes, so we need a lot of people. We have something quite boring for most of you to do, which is we have to move our organization that is behind us. So we have association in Australia, and we have to move to Europe with the association. So we have to create another association. We have to switch all the policies and get all the assets moved and everything. So that's quite boring. But we have to move because we don't have enough members in Australia to fulfill the laws. Yes, exactly. So at the moment it's okay, but we know that we will have to move soon, and that's what we are working at the moment. And we always need people in other things as well, so services and everything. So we can need people. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you very much. Links for everything will be in the show notes. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, I'm at the SecureU booth. Who could you possibly be?
Okay, I'm Eva Stöbel. I'm not from SecureU, but I can tell you a little bit about it. SecureU is a German association to support secure projects, or projects about security, to be more honest. And the major project they support is CA Cert. But they also have a PGP server and some other things. Actually, I'm not so deep into it, so I don't know all the details, but they also support other projects. What they do is they collect money and provide it to those projects. They also have servers running, and they do a little bit advertising and something like this. Not as much, but a little bit, and that's their major focus. And they also compare them a little bit, and low-level research, so that they don't have much manpower to do this. But they also inform about those projects, different ones. So it's not only CA Cert, which we mostly see, but they also have some other ideas as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.